This evening in our study, continuing of 12 Unlikely Heroes, we draw our attention to the character in the Old Testament of Joseph. And tonight our study is entitled Joseph, Suffering But Trusting in God's Sovereignty. Suffering But Trusting in God's Sovereignty. I want us to look, if you will please, in the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis. We're going to start there and kind of work our way backwards a little bit this evening. But in Genesis chapter 50 and verse number 20, we are here in the room where Joseph and his brothers are. Jacob has died. And the brothers are very fearful that now Joseph is going to pay them back for what they had done to him. And I want you to hear what Joseph says in Genesis 50, verse 20, that kind of sets the scene for our study tonight. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. The account of Joseph is one of the most memorized and learned because it has often been shortened to a memorable children's story about a boy with a coat of many colors, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, whose brothers hate him. He's treated unfairly, but then he rises out of the ashes, so to speak, to the top. But the story goes beyond that. The story of Joseph is more than that. The story of Joseph is a journey. It is a journey of what it begins as a teenager, of a young man who was maliciously sold into slavery by his own brothers and is taken to a foreign land, wrongly accused, imprisoned, forgotten, and then restored. He is taken into slavery at 17, and around 40 years later, he goes from being sold by his brothers to having his brothers come before him and bow before him. And he has the authority to execute them, if he so chose to do, after the death of their father. And yet, Joseph, in that one verse, confesses that his life has been lived with a solid comprehension of the sovereignty of God. Joseph's life had been filled with much suffering. And everything that took place, it seemed, one event after another event, we would stand on the sidelines and say, that's unfair. It's unfair what's happening to him. Every time he's doing what's right, he then seems to be punished for it. But yet Joseph never forsakes his trust and confidence in God. Now, many people, in fact, would have told Joseph that God is punishing you, he's out for you, and he has forsaken you. And yet Joseph, as a young man and as he grows into adulthood, is a man who never lost his faith in God. And there he is able to, years after the fact, be able to tell his own brothers that God worked his purposes through all the evil that you did to me. What you did as wicked, he used for good. And in this one verse, and it's one of many, but it is one really good summary of us being able to get insight into the sovereignty of God, and that he uses evil, wickedness, and the sin of human beings for his own purpose. Nothing that happens takes place apart from the decrees and will of God. But we have to ask ourselves a question. How could Joseph get to this place? How could he come here to all these years after the fact and be able to make such a confession? How did Joseph come to this place of being able to speak such words to his brother? I mean, after all, would it not have been natural to have finally seized the moment and exacted revenge over them for what they had done? I mean, it wasn't that they just sold him into slavery, but he was taken away from his family, from his father. Not only that, but look at all the suffering that he had went through. And with one word, you could have had all of their heads chopped off, or whatever he had so chose to desire. After all, he was second in the land. And his brothers certainly were fearful that that was what he was going to do. So let's trace some of the scenes tonight. Now, you cannot be comprehensive and in-depth in one night about the life of Joseph. So we're just going to do a flyover this evening. But I want you to walk with me and let's kind of trace the scenes of the life of Joseph and see how he was a man who suffered yet trusted in the sovereignty of God. So the first scene that we need to understand in the life of Joseph is, number one, there was much family disruption. There was much family disruption. Now, you cannot fully understand what's happening in the life of Joseph unless you understand what's happening in the family life of Joseph and his entire family. One cannot consider the account of Joseph without understanding that the family scene was chaotic in the household of Jacob, who by this time had been renamed Israel. Just a reminder, he had 12 sons with a total of 4 women, 2 sisters that he had married, and of course in their competition with one another had given Jacob their 2 handmaids. So he had 12 sons by 4 women. And so as you can imagine, when they sat together for dinner at the table, it must have always been a very tense and stressful time. Now let's pick it up back in chapter 37, which begins the setting of the scene for the life of Joseph. We are told in verse number 2 in Genesis 37 that the events of Joseph being sold into slavery comes about when Joseph is but only 17 years old. So he's just a teenager. He's 17 years old. So imagine Joseph as he has grown up, these 17 years, he has grown up experiencing a lot of family tension that existed because of the confusing dynamic that filled this family environment. In fact, when you think about everything that happened in the family of Jacob, it's hard to comprehend that it all took place in one family because there are so many numerous conflicts and points of crisis. We've already explained the dynamic of his sons and the 4 women. We've already got that scene, but there's even more. You have the occasion where 2 of his sons, Simeon and Levi, massacre an entire village in Canaan to avenge the raping of their sister. So that happened, and that brought much displeasure to Jacob, obviously. The oldest son of Jacob, Reuben, had went in to one of his father's concubines and had a relationship with her. And that made Jacob angry. And so much so that basically, in a sense, he disowned Reuben. Reuben lost most of all of his firstborn privileges and rights because of that. So that's all happening in the background. And then you have Joseph. And remember that Joseph was the first child that Rachel bore for Jacob. And of course, Rachel was Jacob's favorite. That was the one he loved. And of course, if Rachel has a son, who do you think became the favorite son of Jacob? Joseph. And so Joseph is the favorite. And that means he's hated by the rest of his brothers. Of course, Rachel will have another son, Benjamin, and she dies in childbirth. But the other brothers, they all hate Jacob. They all hate Joseph. Too many J's in here. They all hate Joseph. Now, why did they hate him? Well, number one, because he was the favorite. But second of all, his father did something that made it publicly clear that this was his favorite son, the coat of many colors. Now, there is debate over, was it a coat that had multiple colors, or did it mean that it had long sleeves and went down to his ankles? That debate will continue on until the return of Christ. The point is that Jacob made some garments specially for Joseph to wear, and that identified Joseph as being the favorite of all his sons. So when he wore it, all that did was just basically rubbed it in their face, that this is the favorite. But then it builds this hatred. It builds because in verse number 5, that Joseph had a dream. Now, back in verse 4, because of Joseph being the favorite and having the coat, it says his brothers hated him and they could not speak peacefully to him. They never had anything good to say to Joseph. So that's already how they view him. Now it becomes even more hateful towards him because Joseph dreams a dream and he comes and tells his brothers. He says in verse number 7, "Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, I'm not exactly sure what is the gaps in age, but some of his older brothers would have probably been in their 30s or older. All right? And here he comes as a teenager, basically telling them, "I have dreamed a dream that one day all of you are going to bow to me." Now, if any of you have siblings, you can just imagine, go back to the younger years and just think about a younger sibling coming to you and telling you such would not go over very well. Now, I'm fine with this because I'm the younger one in our, the family. So that's fine with me, this dynamic. But if you're the older ones, not so much. And so they already don't like him. They already hate him. And this just increases it. He then has another dream in verse number 9 and says, "Behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." So not just one time, but twice, he tells his brothers that "I have had dreams and all of you are going to bow to me." Now, I don't know if Joseph said it in a prideful manner or an arrogant manner, if he just shared it with them because he thought it was, you know, it was from the Lord and they needed to know. I don't know that part, but I do know the part of how they felt about it. It just made their hatred for him even stronger. And so, beginning in verse 12 and following, we are told that Joseph also had another job. It was his job to go for his father and check out what the brothers were doing in their keeping of the flock, and then come back and tell him what they were doing. All right? And Joseph probably had no problems telling his father those who were busy on the job and those who were lazy on the job. So that was his job. He was the informant. And so they are off. And we're told that they were down in verse 17 in a place called Dothan, which was approximately 63 miles away from where Jacob and the family were living. So this would have taken several days for Joseph to get there. That means that they're that far away from home that his brothers will have an opportunity they cannot let pass away. Because we are told in verse number 18, "They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say, that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams.'" So obviously you can see they hadn't forgot about the dreams. And so they're way away from home. There's nobody. Jacob's not going to see it. And so it's a perfect opportunity for them to eliminate Joseph. Now, this pit would have been for water, but one person speaks up, and that was the brother Reuben. Reuben said, "Let us not take his life." And he goes on, and basically here's what Reuben wants to do. He wants to create a scenario here where it seems that he rescues, delivers Joseph. Now, why would he do that? Reuben would believe, therefore, it would get him back in good relationship with his father. Remember, he's lost what he had as the firstborn. And to deliver the favorite of Jacob would mean that Reuben surely would be rewarded by his father. So, verse 23 says, when Joseph came, they stripped him of his robe, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. So they had thrown him into a place that would have had just a small enough, a small opening, but he could fit in. But because it's a water well, basically, it meant that all of the walls would have been plastered so that no water could escape. So there's no way for Joseph to climb his way out here. He's stuck. Chapter 42 and verse 21, when they go to Egypt and they begin to be tested by Joseph and they're talking amongst themselves, they talk about this incident, and we're told that Joseph cried out of the pit for them to, you know, let him out, and they ignored it. So, he's there crying out. Verse 25 says, while he's hollering, they sit down to have lunch. They eat. And they get the idea, Reuben is left, and they get the idea, led by Judah, that why don't we make a profit out of this? We'll sell him to this caravan of Ishmaelites, and we'll make some money. And verse 28 says that they made 20 shekels of silver. And Joseph is hauled off and taken to Egypt. Now in verse 29, when Reuben comes back and Joseph's gone, we're told that he cried out and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" So his little plan does not unfold. And so they do this. They take Joseph's robe, kill a goat, dip it in blood, and they take it back to their father and say that Joseph has been killed by a wild beast. Verse 34 says that Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. He has tried to be comforted. He does not. And basically, he just enters into a state of depression because of Joseph's, he believes, death. So, that's the family scene. That's the family disruption that Joseph is in. And out of that, he is sold into slavery. So that's the first scene. Second scene, false accusation. False accusation. We're told in verse 36 of chapter 37 that Joseph was sold to Potiphar, the captain of the guard and officer of Pharaoh. And in chapter 39, we are told about Joseph being in the household of Potiphar. Now, it says in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now what's that tell us? Well, that tells us something very important. It means that Joseph did not get sold into slavery and blame God and curse God and blaspheme God, but that he remained obedient and committed and faithful to the Lord. So even though this was a traumatic event, and I do not at all want you to think it did not affect Joseph. No doubt it did. He was a young man. But still, though, he is faithful to the Lord. He's in this house of this Egyptian. And the Lord blesses his work. And Potiphar, here he is, an Egyptian, but he can recognize that the hand of the Lord is upon Joseph. And look at this. This man who had power, he's close to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he takes a man, young man who's 17, 18 years old, and puts him over all of his house and basically lets him run the place. He runs it, and it said Potiphar had no concern except what he was going to eat every day. That's it. That's how much he trusted Joseph, how well Joseph did, and Joseph did well because God was with him. And so Potiphar lets Joseph run the house, run the field. And he didn't worry about what Joseph was doing. Now that's remarkable. I mean, think about it. If you owned a massive company, who in here would let a 17-year-old run it, basically? I can't think of anybody who would do that. But that is how faithful Joseph was, even in this trying situation. And so, things are going well. This is an important place for Joseph because here he is serving one of Pharaoh's closest advisors, closest officials to the king. And this made sure that Joseph had the opportunity to learn all of the customs and the royal manners of Egypt. And it helps him to see how things function and operate in Egypt under Pharaoh's rule. And all of that is going to be important in a few years to come. So we might say that Joseph has endured the hatred of his brothers, being sold into slavery. He's now here in Potiphar's house. And things are going well. God's blessing him. But there is always a but. And that is that there was somebody in the house who was watching Joseph. We're told in verse 6 that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." And so she attempts to seduce Joseph. We're told he's a handsome man in appearance. The way that these royal type marriages took place, it's very possible that Potiphar was much older than she was. She might have been closer to Joseph's age. Plus, Potiphar was probably most of the time away from home. And she believes she can seduce him. But notice his response. "But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife.'" Now, then here's the key. "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, he respects Potiphar. He says that Potiphar has made him the greatest, the one with most authority in the house. And he said, "He has not kept anything back from me. He has met all of my needs and more. The only thing he's not given me is you, because you're his wife." But then he says, "If I were to do this, I'm sinning against God." And you see, Joseph understands that not only would he be simply sinning against Potiphar, it goes beyond that. He would be sinning against the Almighty. And that gives us again a window into what we can call the theology of Joseph. It is very much God-centered. And that he understands that any sin ultimately is rebellion against God. And so, yes, he could have done this and done it easily. But he said, "I can't do it because it would be violating what God has called me to." Now, remember something. There are no carved Ten Commandments yet. We're here in Genesis. But you can see exactly what we read in the New Testament. The moral law of God has always been. God has always demanded holiness out of his people. He demanded it out of the patriarchs in the book of Genesis. And Joseph here makes clear that for him to do this would be to sin and violate the law of God. And so, she doesn't cease. Verse 10, it says she spoke day after day. And she's trying to break him down. And yet Joseph continues to refuse. And it said on one day in verse 11, when there was nobody there in the house but her and him, she seized his robe, seized his tunic, and said, "Lie with me." And he ran out the house, and left his robe in her hands. Well, she goes from lusting after Joseph, desiring him greatly, to now hating him. And screams out, and basically accuses Joseph of essentially trying to force himself upon her, of raping her. And so, she gives all this then to Potiphar. She blamed Joseph. She blamed Potiphar as well, really, for bringing him into the house. And it says in verse number 20, Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Now, we would all say that's very unfair. How could God... He was being holy, and he gets blamed for it, and he gets taken to prison. And yet, in all of that, I don't want you to miss that God was with Joseph. Number one, where he got put in prison at was a lot better than the other prisons in Egypt. He is taken really to the royal prison. And so that was much better than where the common criminal went to, first of all. But second of all, he's being accused of attempting of committing adultery, essentially. And that in ancient Egypt was punishable by death. If Potiphar had so chosen, he could have had Joseph put to death. But I think it reveals something. I think it reveals that Potiphar probably didn't really believe his wife's accusation. Because what? He had learned who Joseph was. Joseph had demonstrated his heart and his character. And so Joseph is not put to death, but he's put into prison. But nevertheless, it is prison. And it's been a false accusation that has went against this young man. And it then brings us to the third scene in the life of Joseph, of his suffering and yet trusting God. And I want you to see that the third scene is that of a friend who forgets. A friend who forgets. So here he is in prison. And yet, even there in prison, it says in verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison," essentially the warden. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So being a slave in the house of Potiphar, the Lord is with him. Here in the prison, the Lord is with him. And it also lets us see that Joseph is remaining steadfastly committed to the Lord. He didn't go down there blaming God for what's happened. I'm sure he must have asked sometime why, but he still kept faithfully obeying. And those around him, these are not people in Jacob's family. These are Egyptians. They've not been worshiping Yahweh. And yet, though they can see the presence of something in the life of Joseph, and I'm sure Joseph readily explained to them who it was that was with him. Archaeology tells us that in these prisons there were those who were called the scribes of the prison, who were the second in command under the prison wardens. And so that must have been most likely what Joseph, his title would have been. He was experienced in managing the household of Potiphar, and that gave him excellent preparation to be able to manage essentially what's going on in the prison. And remember where he's at. He's in the royal prison. And because he's in the royal prison, in chapter 40, we're introduced to two people who get put in jail. That is the, some translations call it the butler, the ESV, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt, and the baker. Now, we're told they committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. Now, we're not told what they did, but let's just use a little imagination for a moment. And I would say this is a good speculation. The cupbearer in these days was in charge basically of making sure that the food and the drink of the king was not poisoned. He was the taste tester. All right? And the baker is working in the kitchen. So Pharaoh must have thought these two men were maybe part of some plot to kill him. Some treason. I don't know. But they were in charge of food, and if you put, I don't think he put them down there just because the food tasted bad. I mean, after all, as we'll see here in just a moment, the baker was executed. And I don't just think it was because it was a bad pie taste. So it must have been something that Pharaoh thought was severe. But nevertheless, it says in verse 5 that one night they both dreamed a dream, the cupbearer and the baker. And they want to know what it means. And so when Joseph came to see him in verse 6, he said, "You're very troubled." Verse 7, "Why are you so downcast?" They looked very upset, more than usual. And verse 8, they said, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." It's very striking, the Joseph's statement there. It was really a question, but it's a statement. Do not interpretations belong to God? That's basically the same exact statement Daniel gives. If you remember back in Daniel 2, verses 27 through 30. When he goes before Nebuchadnezzar and he said that any dream and interpretation, it comes from God. Only God has the ability to tell you what the future is. And so, he hears both of their dreams, tells the butler that Pharaoh is going to show you mercy and restore you, and he told the baker, not so much. Your days are basically numbered. And sure enough, events come to pass, and the chief baker, he's put to death, but the cupbearer is restored. We're told in verse 20 that on the third day, when it was Pharaoh's birthday, that he did show mercy to the cupbearer, and then he hanged the baker. But Joseph asked something of the cupbearer. He said, "When you are restored, would you please ask Pharaoh for a pardon so that I'm innocent of what I have been accused?" Now, we would think that the cupbearer would have shown gratitude to Joseph. And as soon as he got restored, he would have secured this mercy for Joseph. But verse 23 of chapter 40 says, the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And verse 41 says, 2 whole years passed. Now just imagine for a moment Joseph down there in prison. And when he sees the cupbearer being led up and he's restored. A few days pass. It's got to be any day they're going to release me. A few weeks. A few months. But as the months became a year, and became a year and a half, Joseph must have come to the conclusion that he had been forgotten and that he was not going to be released out of prison. So here was someone else that he had trusted, and he had been forgotten again. However, though, the Lord had not forgotten Joseph, which brings us to the fourth scene. And that is, the fourth scene is famine prophesied. Famine prophesied. Because 2 years have passed, and now Pharaoh has dreams. The first dream is that he's out there on the grassy knoll by the Nile River, and he sees seven healthy, beautiful cows. They're grazing and drinking. And all of a sudden, comes seven sickly, ugly cows stampeding and devouring the healthy cows. But the seven sickly, ugly cows still look ugly and sickly. Then he has another one. It's the same thing, but this time it's about ears of grain. Seven that are plump and good, and then seven that are thin and blighted. And the thin ones consume the plump ones. And he wakes up and he's troubled. And his trouble is persistent because in verse 8, he calls for his magicians and wise men and soothsayers and all the dream people. And they do the same thing that happened in Daniel's day. They can't give an answer. They can't give an interpretation for these dreams. And Pharaoh is upset. In verse 9, the forgetful cupbearer, though, remembers, finally. He remembers about Joseph. And he tells Pharaoh about, this is an interesting way to open a conversation, I remember my offenses today. So, kind of an interesting way to go back and remember what he had done wrong, whatever that was. I don't know if that was the right way to begin the conversation. If Pharaoh's upset with dreams not being interpreted, and you remind him of another bad memory, but nevertheless, he talks to him and he says in verse 12, there was a young Hebrew there who was able to interpret the dream that I had and the dream the baker that you hung, his dream. And so in verse 14, it says, Pharaoh sent and called Joseph. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says in verse 15, I have a dream. Nobody can interpret it, and I've been told you can. And verse 16, now Joseph is here before Pharaoh. Now some people would have told Joseph, you need to make a deal with the king here for your services. That's not what he does. Nor does he come in there and brag about himself. But listen to what he says. It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. And so Joseph makes it clear that it will not be Joseph's ability or power, but it's all of God. So here is still a man who has suffered, but trust in the sovereignty of God. Well, Pharaoh goes back through the dreams that he saw, and then Joseph gives the answer. He tells him that there's going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And he said in verse 32, the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God and God will shortly bring it about. And then Joseph says, now here's what you need to do. You need to select a man who's wise, set him over the land, manage the produce, store it, and be prepared for the famine. And in verse 38, Pharaoh's pleased and said, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. Verse 42, Pharaoh took his signet ring that's got the royal seal, put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold chain on his neck, made him ride in his second chariot, and they called out before him, bow the knee. Now, folks, that's an amazing 24 hours. One night he's sleeping in the jail cell. The next night he's sleeping in the palace. For 13 years, Joseph had been in Egypt. And he had gone from being a Hebrew sold into slavery to now being second in the land. It's a long time. 13 years, and a lot of it went wrong. He'd been treated unfairly. And yet Joseph did not waver in his commitment to the Lord. And at the Lord's appointed time, he was raised up. Our God is a good God. He does all things well. And as I was reminded a few weeks ago, and the scriptures bear it out, that the posture of the Christian is waiting and believing. It's not going to usually happen overnight. It takes persistence and endurance. And Joseph persisted and endured. And here he is delivered. Which brings us to the fifth scene. And that is the scene of the family reunion. Now we're first told that Joseph is blessed with his own family. He gets married in verse number 45. And then in verse number 51, he has two sons. Here's what I want you to see. So, he is now dressing like an Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian. He's, you know, living his life as an Egyptian ruler. And yet, he has not forgotten God. He's not in there worshiping the deities of Egypt. But in verse 41, he called the name of his firstborn Manasseh. For he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. It doesn't mean that he forgot who he was, but he's saying that all that suffering and all the trial that I went through, God has brought me all of this blessing and has made me not to live in the past, but to worship him. And verse 52, the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So he's worshiping and praising God. He recognized that it's God who has brought him to this place, not Joseph's doing. The 7 years of plenty come, and they end. Joseph has made preparation, and now the 7 years of famine come. It said all the earth, in verse 57, came to Egypt to buy again. And then the scene moves back to Canaan. And in verse 42, Jacob hears there's a grain sale, and he tells his sons, why are you staring at each other? You know we need grain. Go down to Egypt and buy that we may live and not die. And so 10 go, 1 stays. Benjamin stays with Jacob because he feared what might happen to him if he went. And so the 10 go down there, and guess who they have to go see? They have to go see Joseph. And of course, in verse number 6, they came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And don't think for a minute that Joseph didn't remember the dreams, because he knows who they are. Verse 7, he saw them and recognized them. So he knows who they are. But they don't know who he is, because he looks like an Egyptian now. And Joseph will only talk to them through a translator. So he wants them to not even for a minute think that that's Joseph they're talking to. And so what he does here, and we're not going to go through the whole chapters here, time won't permit us, but he basically sets up a series of tests. And he wants to prove them and see, have they changed any? Or are they still who they were years ago to him? So, first thing is, in verse 9, it says Joseph remembered the dreams. And he accused them of being spies. They said that we aren't. And Joseph keeps talking to them and getting information out of them, to where one of them talks about, we're all a family and we've all come here except the youngest. He's at home. And so, Joseph says on the third day, he said, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody. Let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, in truth, we are... In truth, remember, they're saying this amongst themselves. In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, they're talking about Joseph now, and that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. He comes back in and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So years have passed. What do we learn? They still feel the guilt for what they've done. And they think it's coming back on them. So Simeon's kept in Egypt. Joseph fills their bags with grain and sends them on their way. And they go back home to Jacob. And they have to tell Jacob, because he's going to wonder where Simeon's at. And they tell him that Simeon's back in Egypt because the man we talked to said he had to stay there and we have to come back. But we have to come back with Benjamin. And of course, Jacob was upset. You know, because Benjamin's dear to his heart. It's the other child of Rachel. And so he can't bear the thought of Benjamin going, and he brings up about Joseph being taken from him, and now that Benjamin would. And so, story continues in chapter 43, that they have to go back because they've run out of grain. And they plead with their father and say, you have to let Benjamin go with us. And so Jacob relents and lets them go. And so, in verse 15, so the men, in chapter 43, the men took this present. And they took double the money with them. They take an offering to take to Joseph from Jacob. They rose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, bring the men into the house and slaughter an animal and make ready for the men are to dine with me at noon. The man did as Joseph told him and brought the men to Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, it is because of the money which was replaced in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may assault us and fall upon us to make us servants and seize our donkeys. Short summary, the brothers of Joseph were a nervous wreck every time they came down to see him, because they were always expecting judgment to fall upon them, because there had been money deliberately put by Joseph into their sacks. And so they come back trying to make peace. And he replies in verse 23, peace to you, do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put treasure in your sacks for you. I received your money. He's testing them. It's always a test to see their hearts. And then he brings Simeon out. Well, they come to eat. And in verse 29, he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your youngest brother, of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son. Then Joseph hurried out, for his compassion grew warm for his brother, and he sought a place to weep, and he entered his chamber and wept there. It's been decades since he had seen his baby brother. And so he's filled with emotion. He's got to excuse himself. It says in verse 31, when he had controlled himself, he comes back in, served the food. I love verse 34. Portions were taken to them from Joseph's table, but Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs, and they drank and were merry with him. Not only did Joseph do that, he had them all sit by order of oldest to youngest. And it says in verse 33, all of his brothers looked in amazement that they were seated that way. That should have, I would think, have given it away then to them. But they didn't. So, In verse 44, here comes the next test. The next test comes. Fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest. That would be Benjamin's, with his money for the grain. And so, verse 3, the brothers leave. Verse 4, they've gone a short distance. And Joseph said to his steward, up, follow after the men. And when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? So he's testing them to see what will they do. It looks like Benjamin had took this to go back home with it. And so, when he overtook them, he spoke to them these words. Verse 7, the brothers say, why does my Lord speak such words as thee? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money that we found in the mouths of our sacks we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then can we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Whichever of your servants is found with it shall die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. And the steward replies, let it be as you say. He who is found with it shall be my servant, and the rest of you shall be innocent. So what they say is, whoever's got it, if someone, one of us stole it, put him to death, and the rest of us become your slaves. And Joseph Stewart says, no, I'll let all of you go, but that one who has stolen it, he has to remain. And in verse 12, and he searched, they go from man to man, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and every man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. They come in there, they plead for mercy, and who is the brother that says, don't keep Benjamin, take me instead? It's Judah. And who was it that said, let's sell Joseph and make a profit? It was Judah. And so Joseph has done all of this to test and see whether they've changed any or not. And he finds the answer that they have. And so, chapter 45, after Judah has pleaded, talked about everything in chapter 44, about I cannot not let them go back to Jacob without Benjamin. It'll kill him. And in chapter 45, Joseph can't control himself any longer. He tells all of his servants to go out of the room, leave him in there with them. He starts crying loud enough that everybody in the house heard it. And he says in verse 3, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? Now, if you want to watch some people that must have turned and looked like ghosts, it had to have been his siblings, because it says they could not answer him. They're speechless because they were dismayed at his presence. So he then says, come here closer to me. You know, you remember that they're nervous. And so Joseph then begins to talk. He talks about seeing Benjamin. He tells them that you've got to get Jacob and bring him back. It says in verse 14, he fell upon Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. He kissed all of his brothers. They wept, and they just, what a sight it must have been. And so they go back in verse 26, and they tell Jacob, Joseph is still alive, and he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart became numb, for he did not believe them. One person said it was like his heart stopped for a minute, is what that means. And he couldn't believe it. And then he said in verse 28, it is enough, Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. And then as you go through chapter 46 and following, verse 28 and following, beautiful scene of Israel and Joseph being reunited. Let's close to the last scene very quickly, the sixth scene. That in chapter 50, forgiveness reiterated. Forgiveness reiterated. In chapter 50, this is after the death of Jacob, and the brothers are still concerned. Verse 15 says, when Jacob had died, they said to one another, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. They fall down in verse 18 and said, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. His whole life revolved around a confidence in the sovereignty of God. And he believed that they would go back to Canaan. And he said to take his bones back and bury them in the land. Hebrews 11 and verse 22 describes that he said that by faith. If you have not already been able to see that there are many parallels tonight between Joseph and the Lord Jesus. Both were hated by their brothers. Joseph was hated by his brothers. Jesus was rejected by a nation, came unto his own, and his own did not receive him. Both were stripped of their robes. Both were sold for the price of a slave. Both were bound in chains. Both were condemned with criminals. And after both suffered, they were exalted. Joseph to a place of great power in Egypt, but the Lord Jesus Christ, far greater than that. Seated at the right hand of the Father, making intercession constantly for us. And so this evening, we're thankful for the testimony of Joseph. But we are thankful that a greater than Joseph came. And he took our place and became our substitute so that we would be brought into his family for all eternity. Father, I pray that you would help us. Use the life of Joseph in our lives. That we will suffer. We will be persecuted for living a life seeking to be holy as you are. But in the midst of that suffering, help us to continually trust in your sovereignty, knowing that you indeed work all things for the good of those who love you. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen.